This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're talking about the ongoing protests happening in Indiana and across the country, both a direct response to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis and a larger call to action for police reform and major changes to combat what many call institutionalized racism. If you have any questions or comments, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, 866-476-3881. We'll be live for most of the show today to talk with protesters about their message and their goals, and with a social policy researcher about what real change might look like. But first, a pre-taped conversation with David Hampton, Deputy Mayor of Neighborhood Engagement for the City of Indianapolis. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, just so people know, can you explain what you do in your position at the city?
Sure. I am Deputy Mayor of Neighborhood Engagement. I oversee various departments, one of which includes our mayor's neighborhood advocates who represent all of our neighborhood districts, as well as the Citizens Police Complaint Office, International Affairs, the Mayor's Youth Council. And I do quite a bit of work with police community relations in the city.
What's your role been so far during these protests?
It's been very difficult. You know, on the one hand, I'm a professional. On the other hand, I'm a black man and a father as well. And so my heart pours out to everyone in the wake of the pain and, the discussions that we continue to have to face on a repeated basis.
Why do you think these protests have been so much larger and long lasting than some protests about similar issues have been in the past?
Well, I think that, the video of George Floyd was very visceral, not just for black people, but I think for white people and for people around the nation and world. Anyone with a heart of compassion felt something when they saw that video. And these protests are really an outgrowth of continued frustration with cases like that, very similar. I mean, right there in Minnesota, you have Philando Castile, whose killer was found not guilty. And then the choking itself was very reminiscent of Eric Garner, almost an identical circumstance. And to see those types of tragedies occur with impunity frustrates a lot of people to the point that it is it's come to a boiling point. And I think people are frustrated. They're tired, exhausted, and want to see tangible change.
How do you think police have handled the protests in Indianapolis? IMPD's gotten criticism, as many police departments around the country have, for using tear gas in situations that were otherwise peaceful.
Well, you know, I'm in a difficult situation working for the city of Indianapolis.
Sure.
And I know that our men and women of IMPD, there are some great, great, dedicated men and women who work for our police department and many police departments around our country. But I think they do understand that they are the objects of frustration right now. And I do want to say IMPD has worked with me personally and the administration to really foster positive and peaceful protests. They understand protesters have a constitutional right to do so. I think the struggle has been how to maintain safety around that and ensure that they remain safe, as well as police officers going home at night to their families as well. So it has been a very difficult tightrope for everyone, but I think the protesters are being heard in a safe way here in Indianapolis. We've had some tragedies to occur, and we have to continue to work through those things to correct and ensure they don't happen again.
And you said in a recent interview with Indianapolis Monthly that, and I'm quoting here, we need to see a different form of policing in our country, end quote. What did you mean by that?
Well, we do need to see some police reforms. You know, I think the idea of qualified immunity poses some huge problems. You know, and when we, again, when we saw the knee to the neck of George Floyd, that was a poignant metaphor for how black and brown people feel in their relationship to police officers in America. And it is a poignant metaphor for a knee to the neck of economic inequities, inequities within our criminal justice system, inequities socioeconomically, politically, across the board, education, you name it. It is a knee to the neck on other social ills that I think have arisen to the forefront of conversation. And I think these are important conversations to have. Now, how that reform looks, I think we're working through that, not only as a city, but as a nation. But we cannot continue to watch black and brown people die at the hands of police. And when they are found to use, you know, policies or use of force methods that are unauthorized, then something has to be done more than a discussion or more than desk duty.
Today, we're talking about the ongoing protests happening in Indiana and around the U.S., and we are joined in this first segment with David Hampton, Deputy Mayor of Neighborhood Engagement for the City of Indianapolis, and we will be joined by a live panel later this hour. And if you would like to get your questions or comments in front of our live panel, you can do that on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. So, David, what happened when protesters went to the governor's mansion last week?
Well, first of all, let me say there are different protest groups, and I want to commend a lot of the groups for their organization, and these are primarily young people. I consider myself an old head, so these are young people in their teens and 20s. If they're over 30, that's even rare. But when they decided to march at the governor's mansion, as with most of the protests, I have been present. So that certainly wasn't the first time I had gone to one of the protest sites. But once I saw there was tension between protesters and police, I just felt it was my job to step in. And all I did was simply attempt to diffuse what appeared to be a very potentially dangerous situation. And so my thought at that moment was, I'm a father. If my son and daughters were out here, I would not want to see anything happen to them. And so I diffused the situation the best way I could. And what happened from there was certainly outside of my control. But at the end of the day, there was peace. At the end of the day, no one was shot. No one was killed. And, you know, I think that anybody who can walk away and say there was no injury, there was no death, we should all be happy about that.
And there was a lot of media coverage at that protest of the moment police officers walked with protesters and exchanged hugs. I mean, some saw this as a beautiful moment, but some saw it as an empty gesture and something that might give people a false sense of progress. What did you make of that moment and the reactions to it?
Yeah, and that's why I was very careful to distinguish what my role was as a city official. And personally, you know, as a man of God as well, my role was simply to diffuse a very potentially dangerous situation. It was the protesters who decided to shake hands, to hug with the police. It was the police who decided to take a knee and to begin to walk with protesters. And I thought that if that's an extension of the outgrowth of the peace that was taking place in that moment, it was very spontaneous. I thought it was very sincere on the part of the police. And again, at the end of the day, there was peace. Now, here's the other side of that argument. The chants that we hear are no justice, no peace. What protesters want to see is justice. We all want to see peace. We want to see peaceful protests. We all want to see the police be peaceful. But what we want as a society is justice. And that's the part we're not getting. Justice. That's what people feel.
And so you say that you saw it as sincere. So this idea that it is an empty gesture, I mean, that is an opinion that is coming from one side of the argument. But you were there and you were, it sounds like, integral in at least part of the process to get us to that point where there was this sort of dialogue, this interaction in, between protesters and the police. And so you saw it as, did you see it as a real sort of a moment of change, something indicative, something representative?
I thought it was a conversation starter, and people who watched it live, they could sort of see the circumstance unfold. I thought it was spontaneous, and I certainly can't judge the hearts of anyone, but it seemed sincere in that moment, and that's something that some of those protesters and police would, you know, be able to speak further about. But I do think that, again, it ought to be a conversation starter that gets everyone at the table and listen. We need to listen to one another. And I think that our city officials are beginning to listen. I think our mayor has been listening, and he's made strides in the past few days. Of course, whatever is within his power, I know that he is and will change. But we have a lot of work to continue in the area of racial reparations and reconciliation. I think that's a major factor here. It is years of racial inequity and systematic injustice that is the foundation of frustration of the protests we see around the country and around the world.
Well, let's get to the big question before we wrap up, and we only have about a minute left. What is the biggest obstacle ahead for people who want real change to come from this, would you say?
Well, I think the biggest obstacle is the systems themselves, if they are willing to relinquish some of the inequitable controls that exist, we will see change. The more we see the systems themselves hold on to that power structure that has not proven to be good for the people, then we're going to continue to see some huge obstacles ahead of us. There must be change. There must be a willingness to change laws and policies that have been oppressive for years and years and generations.
David Hampton is Deputy Mayor of Neighborhood Engagement for the City of Indianapolis. David, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Up next, we'll be live with a group of protesters and a social policy researcher to talk about the ideas and demands coming out of this protest. We're back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the ongoing protests in cities across Indiana and the country pushing for police reform and major changes to combat institutionalized racism. As always, when we are live, we love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're joined live now by four people. On the phone, we have Matt Davis, longtime organizer and co-chair of the Indiana Racial Justice Alliance. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how's it going? Glad to be here.
Also on the phone, we have Bree Robbie, who's been participating in the protests. Hi, Bree.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. And on Skype, we have Michelle Anastasia, a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter, a local chapter of that group. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And we also want to welcome Brianka Merritt, a clinical assistant professor at IUPUI and director of the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy at the IU Public Policy Institute. Welcome to you, Brianka.
Thanks for having me.
Matt, we'll start with you. We did a show last Monday where we talked to reporters about the protests that happened that weekend. Can you give us an update on what's happened since? What have these protests looked like in the last few days?
So in the last few days, it's been so during the weekdays, it's usually just a lot of young people. Similar to what David Hampton was just talking about, you see a lot of just young people under 25 out there just kind of leading different protests, demonstrations, rather, because protests need clear demands, right? There needs to be an if-then type of dynamic to a protest. So You just see these demonstrations that are just passionate young people saying that they won't stand for an unjust and corrupt police department. Mainly white kids, ironically, during the weekdays, and then it's a multiracial just coalition of people out there every weekend for some of the more focused demonstrations that have demands and protests behind them. So I go out there and I just try to give it some structure, give it some civil disobedience, right, to give it some direction, and just teach some of the young people how to navigate trying to get your demands met, how to lay out demands that are about the system. And we have so many great criminal justice advocates in the city who work on case-specific work like Black Lives Matter Indy and the Trayvon Reed case and Aaron Bailey and Mac Long and going back 6 years and even longer, right? So I just go out there. I try to play my part with direct action and just do different marches and do different things. I'm not the only one, but I'm just kind of one of the more consistent ones. I help volunteer with Black Lives Matter and other groups as well. So that's what is going on day to day, usually going on the circle in the afternoon, and then we do some marching around and come back.
Some of the biggest criticisms of these protests on the local and, of course, on the national level is, of course, surrounding some of the violence that has erupted adjacent to these protests. From an organizational standpoint, I know that officially, of course, when these protests come together, officially they are they come together as peaceful protests, and then they sort of devolve into violence when they have, which has certainly not been the majority of the time. From an organizational standpoint, what do you say or do to discourage that?
Well, first I'd like to say that any chaos, any mayhem, any trauma, any harassment, like all of that is initiated. And I want to be clear about that. It is initiated by IMPD. When you see these Indianapolis protests, they are escalated because of IMPD. Unwarranted harassment of protesters and really, honestly, tear gas that should not be used on civilians at all, right? Pepper bullets, rubber bullets, brutality, billy clubs, right? All of this is coming from the department. So they try to agitate you into a certain type of response that then encourages a certain behavior, especially as you get further and further into the night and people want to escalate the same way that the department has because they're angry and protesting the brutality and harassment that they're experiencing even at the protest. So I just want to start there, that the police and the IMPD are the ones that initiate the chaotic environment. And then that encourages some of the violence that you see in Detroit and other Midwestern cities. And also, unfortunately, yes, we have had some of that happen here in Indianapolis, but that is part and parcel of the environment that's created and encouraged and then incubated by the police as we have moved on. And I think as a community, we are developing some more ethics around how we go about organizing and keeping about the demonstration and the protest even into the night. And you see that across the country. That's not just particular to Indianapolis. But I just want to say that it is at the feet of the police everywhere, the violence that you see.
Have the protests you've seen and been a part of changed over the last couple of weeks in any way, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that, again, I think a lot of it was broad-based demonstrations. Aside from the early work that you saw in the Trayvon Reed and the 3 and 8, the three people who were killed in 8 hours earlier in the month here in Indianapolis created a powder keg effect that George Floyd just blew up, right? It was just waiting on that moment to kind of trigger an uprising, right? So earlier in the month, you already see some organizing happening out of some early protests that were a little unruly, if people want to call it that. But you got to remember, people are expressing so much trauma. You got to put that in context. And then that got honed in by Black Lives Matter Indy 10, and they were able to harness that energy. And the press conference with the mother of Trayvon was a real capstone, and then that made that whole 62nd and Michigan site more of a memorial peace and remembrance site, right? And then we took that energy into this George Floyd uprising that's happening across the country, And then obviously there's a lot of energy to corral out of that. And then now you're seeing more criminal justice advocates and abolitionist groups moving forward on different issue campaigns, like Justice for Trayvon and the Indiana Racial Justice Alliance talking about defunding the police, refunding communities, an external review board, the FOP paying their own independent liability insurance. So we're on the move in terms of more systemic strategy across the country. You're starting to see it. Indianapolis has already defunded their police completely and already abolished them. So you're seeing a shift in the overall just political strategy of what's going on is we're moving into the institution work, and we're looking for institutional changes to come from this. And the fruit of it will not only be better policing, but better communities.
Matt, I want to hear from another one of your fellow protesters. Bree Robbie is with us. Bree, a lot of people have shown up to protests in cities across the state. And although this started as a response to the police killing of George Floyd, there are a lot of issues being raised by protesters. What got you to participate? What message do you want to send?
Yes. Well, I'd first like to say that in Indianapolis, this started before George Floyd. We've been out here chanting Black Lives Matter for years. We've been chanting Aaron Bailey before George Floyd, and we chant Trayvon Reed now. Behind the phrase Black Lives Matter, there's a lot. The starting point is police brutality, but the conversation has to go further than that. Black Lives Matter also means that we must stop treating Black people like second-class citizens. We must reform the criminal justice system and address the disproportionate number of Black men incarcerated. We must reform our education system and pay teachers more, provide more funding to public schools, and abolish the school-to-prison pipeline. And I would say that we even need to defund our police and give that money back to our Black communities and to provide social and rehabilitation services to our Black communities. We need to ensure that Black women are paid just as much as white men. And we have to stop blocking access for Black progressives to run for office. So we have to create a country of equity and stop settling for the bare minimum. And police brutality is just the beginning of this conversation, and I know that many of us will still be continuing this conversation and continuing protests as it goes on.
Bree, how long will you show up to protests, would you say?
Well, first and foremost, I will be out there until we see any action from Mayor Hogsett regarding justice for Trayvon Reed. That's definitely the thing that is driving me the most right now. But as an advocate, I will continue to be out there and to show up and to stand behind Indy 10 Black Lives Matter until we have equity in this country.
We are live talking about the protests that have been going on in Indiana and, of course, throughout the country. But specifically, we're talking about Indiana protests today. And we are live with Matt Davis, a longtime organizer and co-chair of the Indiana Racial Justice Alliance. Bree Robbie, who we just spoke with, has been participating in the protests in Indianapolis. We also have Michelle Anastasia, a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter, a local chapter of Black Lives Matter. And Brianka Merritt is a clinical assistant professor at IUPUI and director of the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy at the IU Public Policy Institute. And we are looking for your commentary and your questions for our panel. You can do that on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Michelle, you're a member of Indy 10, which is the local chapter of Black Lives Matter. What has your experience been like being part of these protests compared to others you've been a part of?
My experience has been that there has been a lot more youth involvement, direct youth involvement, which is beautiful to see. So that presents opportunity for more teaching and learning on both sides. So teaching and learning from a seasoned side in terms of like political activism and moving towards radical revolution and radical social justice. And then also with some youth that are coming in with fresh ideas and fresh viewpoints that are important and valuable and will help carry us over these next few pushes as we continue to fight for justice.
What about the diversity of the protests and the people involved? Have you been, are you satisfied with the makeup, I guess, of the crowds that you've been among?
We're always excited when you see people come out. I think it's vital that white and non-Black allies inform themselves before coming to protests, so that way we can offer as much protection to the Black bodies that are protesting as possible. We have had some incidences where we have white allies come out and they don't know how to protest safely, or they aren't fully informed on the issues, or they don't know that you have to default to the organizers and leaders in charge, and that you can't co-opt this movement. That's not how it's going to happen. So it's always the advice that we give to offer people surge training, so that they can be trained and aware and make sure that their impact aligns with their intent. We don't want allies to come and offer a different impact because their intent isn't clear. The diversity. The diversity needs to always happen because none of us will get anywhere on our own. But we always need to remain focused that this is about Black lives.
I think it's important to expand on that. So what are some examples of things that you have seen that have come from white protesters that really should have looked differently in your view?
White protesters need to listen to the leadership in charge, specifically the leadership of Indy 10. These are women and femmes who have been organizing for years, not just protesting, but organizing, working behind the scenes, talking to city officials, working with families who have been traumatized after police interactions or police murders of their children. So there's a lot more to it than just what's happening right now. There's a lot of years of work, a lot of relationships, a lot of dynamics that are important as we continue things on a local level. We can address all of the national injustice, and that's great, but we also have to make sure that we focus on fixing our city while we're doing that.
I guess if we could simplify that and maybe distill it down, what would you say to white supporters who have yet to show up to these protests, who are thinking about it? What would you say to them as they prepare their visit, as they prepare their materials? What do they need to be? What do they need to keep in mind, I suppose?
They need to be protecting instead of filming. So the important thing is to not be on live the whole time you're at a protest. The important thing is for your head to be on a swivel, for you to be an ally, a wall in between the riot police that we're presented with at every protest, and that you are protecting those Black bodies. It is important that you know before you come out that the Black bodies are the leaders. It is important that you know that the various levels of your privilege, whether or not you come from another intersectional group, whether or not you're queer or have different physical capabilities or different language barriers or educational barriers, it still is about fighting for justice for Black persons in America right now. So we need to make sure that that's focused. I always suggest for white allies to go to a surge training before they even come out. So standing up for racial justice, that way they have the most accurate tools. And surge folks are taught by Black people so that they can take the labor off of Black people for teaching about all of the racial injustice that's happened for hundreds of years. So I would say go to a surge training, read up, go to another surge training, and listen.
Thanks for that perspective. Michelle, one more question. We only have about a minute and a half left in this segment. What has the organization around these protests look like? Black Lives Matter is probably the most commonly known group nationally that's helping to organize, but there are plenty of other grassroots groups out there. Are these groups working together, would you say, maybe more than they have in the past?
I think that there has been more togetherness. Indy 10, in particular here in Indianapolis, our Black Lives Matter group is always going to be focused on helping whoever is ready to fight for justice. So it doesn't always have to be about us. We're not the focus. The community is the focus. So it's been nice to see young people that aren't from Indy 10 that want to join Indy 10 or want to join other organizations to continue to move. And I think all of the organizations have done their part in making sure that everyone stays as safe as possible inside of unsafe conditions. Indy 10 personally takes the aspect of providing medics and care to the best of our abilities, regardless of whose actual protest it is or who planned the protest. Frequently, these aren't protests that we've planned. Sometimes they are protests that we've planned, but we do our best to provide some of the knowledge and access that we have developed over the years to those who may not have the same.
We'll be back with our live guests after a quick break to continue this conversation. And of course, you can send us your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a short voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the ongoing protests in cities across Indiana and the country, pushing for police reform and major changes to combat institutionalized racism. And we would love to hear your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. And we're joined again by a live panel of guests. Matt Davis is longtime organizer and co-chair of the Indiana Racial Justice Alliance. Bree Robbie has been participating in the protests, and she joins us by phone. Michelle Anastasia is a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter, a local chapter of Black Lives Matter. And one voice we have not yet heard from is Brianka Merritt, clinical assistant professor at IUPUI and director of the Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy at the IU Public Policy Institute. So, Brianka, we'll start this segment with you. You specialize in policy, and it seems like as these protests have gone on, demands from protesters have gotten more specific and more policy focused. Have you noticed that? What's stuck out to you about these protests so far?
Well, yeah, I think our other guests so far have really spoken to that, which is that they didn't materialize out of thin air. Folks within Indy, activist organizers, have been doing this work for a very long time. So they've been developing a lot of the language around the types of reforms that they want to see. And so I think when we think about traditional protest, again, it's in response to an event. And so we've been focusing a lot of activity in the media outlets around, you know, the George Floyd in reaction to that, and Ahmaud Arbery and many others, including here in Indianapolis. But this work has been going on for a very long time, and the issues related to systemic and institutionalized racism have been around for a long time as well. So certainly these activities have increased police brutality that's more visible over the past couple of weeks, have certainly maybe brought more non-Black folks to the table in terms of seeing what is happening. But the folks who've been doing this work for a long time have been working on different types of language around what they would like to see. And now we're at the point where, since there are more white allies on the ground at the protest and visibly supporting these efforts, that they can say, all right, well, here's what we would like for you to do. And they're getting response to some of those policy demands. So that is very different. But again, it's something that's been in the works for a long time, too.
Right. There are aspects of this that are fairly narrow, specific changes people want from police departments, like a ban on chokeholds, for instance. But a lot of the surrounding issues are incredibly complicated issues referred to sometimes under the banner of institutionalized racism or systemic racism. How much of a challenge is it to turn these bigger, more complex problems fueling a protest movement into specific policy changes?
Sure. I think it's incredibly difficult. And I think just even within the scope of police brutality, the biggest issue that keeps coming up and has really been going on, you know, forever is how we hold organizations and institutions accountable for their behavior, and specifically as it relates to Black people. And the reason why this is pretty contentious generally is because race has always been, quote, a hot button topic, particularly for non-Black politicians to pick up. What are my constituents going to think? Who do they think I might be allied with? And that really prevents really substantive conversations from happening, because the conversation is always around, you know, kind of tiptoeing around the margins. I think Indy in particular has a very consistent history with being not just quiet about these issues, but also to the point of bragging about, you know, polite protests and the fact that, you know, when MLK was assassinated, Dr. King, that Indy was one of the cities that didn't riot. And we kind of prided ourselves on being a city that does not react strongly. And so that culture has really kind of fed into an inability to say, not only are we going to hold organizations, individuals within them accountable for upholding systemic inequities, but how do we, you know, measure that in a way that, you know, we can make sure that people are going to do the right things as it relates to racial equity, but then also, again, kind of walk this fine line around when we don't want to upset constituents who might not think that's a worthwhile effort.
Well, we've mentioned the terms institutionalized racism and systemic racism a few times today, and these are not new terms, but we're seeing them used more often these days, of course, and in more mainstream places. Can you explain what they mean?
Yeah, I will start off by saying it is absolutely wild that for those of us who have been doing this work for so long, to hear news outlets and laypersons just use the words institutionalized racism, intersectionality, just, and it flows off the tongue. It's really mind-boggling. But what that means, as everyone else has kind of alluded to, is that there are structural factors within public policies, within public, nonprofit, private organizations that prevent equitable outcomes from occurring for different populations, and in this case, for Black folks. And what that means is that, in our case, that so many efforts have been built into the American political system and policy system for so long that even if Black folks are given an opportunity to make progress on one area, there are about 50 other efforts that kind of complicate that and make it that much more difficult to move past a particular barrier. And so as we hear about these calls for addressing systemic racism, they're talking about, you know, how do we make our educational systems more equitable for Black students? How do we keep them from being disciplined and suspended at higher rates that increases the school-to-prison pipeline, which makes them more likely to be incarcerated, interact with the criminal justice system? So it's the fact that all of these complexities take place and they're primarily targeted toward Black people, and there aren't a lot of opportunities to move away from some of those negative outcomes.
Matt Davis is with us. He's been leading a number of the protests in Indianapolis with the Indiana Racial Justice Alliance. Matt, can you tell us about the group?
Yeah. So it's a group that we've been planning, honestly, since the beginning of 2020, so not too long. It was before George Floyd and obviously before Drayjean, too. But the group is just an alliance of other grassroots groups taking on issue campaigns across the state. For racial justice in immigration, criminal justice, and voting rights. And the steering committee is made up of a bunch of, honestly, mainly just newer groups. And the issue committees were pulling in some more established people for criminal justice, immigration, voting rights. And the overall objective is to amplify the voices that are already going on. So me as an individual, even before we were more public about the alliance, I've just been out there volunteering for different groups. You know what I mean? So as an alliance, we want to have the same effect of just amplifying other people's demands, amplifying other people's work, and just trying to hone them into more systemic demands in those three areas. So, for example, for criminal justice, our four demands for the rest of the year going into 2021 are defund IMPD, defund the percentage of them. And I can talk another time, maybe some other interview, about where the cuts need to be made. But just to give people an idea, you know, what do cops do aside from homicides that should come from detectives? What do they do where they're actually needed, right? What do they do? What can be done without a gun? Those are just some questions to start to think about when you want to entertain the defund conversation. So I just wanted to put that out there to folks. So the main thing is to defund a percentage of IMPD and refund community services and programs. And what we mean by refund, that's important, not just investing, but refunding historically divested public institutions like schools, Indy Parks, and so many other essential community service, public transit, all these different things have been defunded historically and then put into this overinflated public safety budget year in, year out, election after election. So that's the first part, is defund IMPD and refund our communities. The second thing is to create a community-led external review board. This is really important, and there's precedents for this. Rhode Island has some a great model for citizen oversight and participation. And what this needs to look like is not what this joke of a use of force policy committee that Joe Hogsett and the mayor's office just created, putting the firearms board and all these other things under there, but it's still run by the department. And that external review is important for just overall citizen oversight and accountability. And then the fourth demand, the third demand is that internal affairs with IMPD or HR go under external review, right? How can the police themselves? It's impossible. So their internal affairs, there's two main things that really happen to people on an everyday level that are just the worst things that you can imagine, a murder and a rape. Neither one of those are getting solved, right? What are police actually doing? And then also, they are out here murdering people, and they are also out here harassing and raping people, too. How can they handle that unto themselves? They can't. Their internal affairs, their HR has to go under external review. The last demand is that the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, a very corrupt and almost indestructible police union, should have its independent liability insurance. So City Council and the mayor's office should not renew the contract at the end of 2020 with FOP without them having to pay for civil suits and other settlement legal fees attached to police action murders and all these other forms of misconduct that we see from the department. They should be paying for that, not taxpayer dollars. So the FOP should pay for their own misconduct. So those are our four demands for criminal justice. We're organizing several different, not only criminal justice groups, but then just groups who are interested and want to see change for the entire department. And then also, lastly, we stand behind the Justice for Drayjean campaign with Indy 10 and everyone behind that as well.
We are on the phone with Matt Davis, a longtime organizer and co-chair of the Indiana Racial Justice Alliance. We are talking about the protests in Indiana over the last couple of weeks. We also have Michelle Anastasia, a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter, and Brianka Merritt, a clinical assistant professor at IUPUI, to talk about some of the public policy implications of the protests and the response. And on the phone also, we have Bree Robbie, who's been participating in the protests. Bree, have you been a part of past protests about this or similar issues?
Absolutely. I've been around for a lot of these protests and these movements, essentially since Black Lives Matter became a thing, became an organization. So I'm not unfamiliar to what's happening.
How do you feel right now about the potential for real change? Do these large-scale protests make you feel hopeful?
Absolutely. It's great to see so many people openly speaking up and saying Black Lives Matter. Definitely a lot of people who I would never expect it to. And it's unfortunate that George Floyd's death was the catalyst for this, but I am hopeful that because so many people are openly and willing to admit that racism exists and willing to educate themselves on it, that change really can stem from what's happening right now.
What are those unexpected faces that you've seen in support that have heartened you so?
I don't want to call anyone out, but I've just seen a lot of people who maybe weren't privy to their white privilege before now coming out. They're getting tear gas, so they're understanding now the way that police treat us all of the time. And they are not only coming out to protest, but they're sharing reading material. They're trying to educate people who've never acknowledged that racism exists now and getting them to learn that it exists, but also getting them to learn how to dismantle it.
Michelle, we played a conversation at the top of the show with David Hampton, deputy mayor of neighborhood engagement for Indianapolis. What did you think of his comments on this?
I believe that this is a movement and not a moment. I think that we would do better to not straddle a fence of justice. And I don't think you can do that and really, really advocate for community. There are no checks and balances within the police force here in Indianapolis. So until we have that, you can't really say you're advocating for community unless you're really showing up for community and unless you are that check and balance inside the system. Personally, Indy 10, myself and Indy 10 as an organization, we believe in divestment and defunding. We are police abolitionists. So I don't think that a police state is something that's profitable for the furtherment of Black justice or social justice across the country. So I think that the words that he's saying are nice, but I'm not seeing tangible actions, the same tangible actions that we've been asking for as a group for the past 6 years to take some money out of the police department, some or all, and put it back into schools, to put it into food justice in the city, to put it into accessibility, to put it into children, to put it into the parks. And we haven't seen that happen. So I don't think you can say that you are advocating for community if you aren't advocating for those things to be done, to take money away from the police to do so.
Priyanka, what have you thought about the media coverage these protests have gotten so far?
I think in the beginning, I think echoing Michelle's point that folks on the ground and folks who live this daily view this as a movement and not a moment. And so what it takes to create long-term systemic change looks very different from kind of a pop-up protest, which I think is how it was framed in the beginning, as if there weren't organized efforts prior to the killing of George Floyd. And I think the coverage primarily at the beginning was very much around like, wow, I can't believe this thing is happening, to let's focus on, you know, rioters and looters, and this is detracting from the message. Let's figure out a different way to protest. So that did kind of suck up some of the air of the room, which is totally against what the organizers on the ground were doing and supporting. And so to have that distraction, and even through last week, still seeing, at least on the national media, you know, aerial shots of people stealing and breaking windows, totally detracted from the huge outpouring of effort that had been taking place on the ground for years. And so I think now we see more conversations since more non-Black folks have been involved and consistently showing up and consistently growing. I think the growth and the consistency is now to the point where it really can't be ignored. And so again, if people are moving toward this being a longer term movement and not just a response to an incident, that the conversation, I think, is starting to shift toward, okay, well, what are we going to do? Because these people aren't going to stop coming out in a multiracial way.
Matt, we have less than a minute left. I want to make sure we get to this. There's been a lot of talking since these protests started about who is showing up and whether certain groups are taking advantage of the moment to create tension and sometimes violence. What is your sense on that right now? Are there conflicting groups participating? In about 30 seconds.
I always think that there are counter-protests. During the revolutionary times in American history, you know, the Black Liberation Movement, other movements in the 60s and 70s that were counter-revolutionaries. I think right now we're seeing, this is an uprising, so you're seeing a counter-protest happening. The young man that walked all those other young people up to the governor's mansion, that is a counter-protest. Very suspect background, even more suspect intentions. Just so happens to have a deputy mayor up there. They just so happen to have a conversation with the police. They just so happen to be hugging and trying to shake hands. All very staged, all very performative, all felt like a setup. And then we had to collectively, me representing not just one group that day, but the collective struggle against IMPD, had to walk 55 blocks back downtown.
We're going to have to leave it at that, Matt. I'm so sorry. Matt Davis is a longtime organizer and co-chair of Indiana Racial Justice Alliance. We've also been joined by Michelle Anastasia, Bree Robbie, and Priyanka Merritt today. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you for listening. This is All In.